Epicureans focused on kinds of happiness that last a long time, like friendship, a beautiful garden, or thinking about philosophy. Bridger: Not pretzels? Carlyle: Pretzels are good, but they aren't going to make your whole life happy. Just a few minutes while you eat the pretzel. They're a temporary good, instead of a permanent good. And if you eat too many pretzels, it can make you sick, and then you'll be less happy. Bridger: I want to test that scientifically. He grinned. Can we do that next time at Science Club? Test how many pretzels it takes to make you sick? It was Thisbe he looked to for permission. Can we ask Dr. Weeksbooth? Thisbe chuckled darkly. I don't think so. Dr. Weeksbooth wouldn't want to run an experiment that will make everybody sick. But I bet we could ask them to do a lesson on the digestive system, so you can calculate yourself how many pretzels it could hold. And then I can eat one less than that. Carlyle smiled as the happy tangent eased the boy's fidgeting. Science Club sounds fun. It is. Last week we learned about siphons, and we made a goop siphon that siphoned with no tube. Impressive. He caught the boy's eyes. It sounds like you learned great things with Dr. Weeksbooth. Yup. Now do you want to learn with me? About how Neo-Epicureanism and Epicureanism are different? Reframed like science class, this death discussion wasn't quite so scary. Sure. Neo-Epicureanism is an economic philosophy from only 300 years ago. So how many years newer is that than Epicureanism? The boy hummed tunelessly as he racked his memory. I forgot how old the first one was. 2,800 years old. Then the new one is 2,500 years newer than the old one. That's right. That's easy. He looked to Thisbe for an approving nod and got one. Neo-Epicureanism says that whether there is an afterlife or not, people are healthier, more productive, and live longer if they're happy. So the government, for us the hive, should try to make sure people live in ways that make them happy. Living in a bash with a group of friends that you have fun with every day is one of the institutions the Neo-Epicureans promoted to help people be happy. The original Epicureans probably would have liked the bash, and their ideas helped it spread, but they didn't come up with it. Regan Makoto Cullen came up with it, based on Brillism, which is another fairly recent philosophy. I smiled as I watched over Thisbe's tracker feed. Some people talk down to children, as if they assume a small body houses a small intellect. Some people talk past them, bludgeoning them with unfamiliar words until the kids accept what they can't understand. Chance, or providence, whichever you prefer, had sent Bridger a sensei who treated the child as an equal intelligence, just blessed with newness, ready for difficult things, so long as they were presented honestly. And Epicureans think it's good to die? The child hugged his dog. Man: No, but ancient Epicureans thought it wasn't bad to die. Child: Why not? Man: Because they thought death was nothing. And there's no reason to be afraid of nothing, since it won't hurt you. It's just nothing. Child: But there's no more you. Man: That's true. Do you think that's bad? Child: Of course it's bad. You can't be happy anymore if there's no you. You can't eat, or have parties, or a dog, or play, or have a pretzel ever again. I don't like that. I don't want Pointer to not get to do that anymore. Man: But if you're dead, you also can't be sad, or in pain, or hurt, or lonely. Child: That doesn't make up for it. I like me, and I like gardens and my friends. I think everybody likes themselves and their friends. How could they think it's not bad to lose all that? I think they're stupid, Epicureans. Man: I don't think they're stupid, but I do think you have a very reasonable objection. There are many answers to your question when you ask why they thought death without an afterlife could be good. One possible answer has to do with how different life was back then. Child: what do you mean? Man: Epicureans thought of pleasure as the absence of pain. That is, when you aren't hurting or angry or sad or lonely or anything else bad, that's pleasure. It's what we call a negative definition, defining something by what it isn't rather than what it is. Like, clean means something isn't dirty, and dark means there isn't light. Child: but pleasure is when you feel happy or good. Man: that's a positive definition, saying what it is, not what it isn't. They used a negative definition instead. Child: why? Man: a lot of people think it has to do with the difference between what life was like in ancient Greece and what life is like now. Nowadays, life is pretty good, don't you think? You aren't in pain very often, or sick, or hungry, or alone, and you don't have to worry about your home getting smashed or your friends all getting killed by raiders. He frowned in sympathy as the boy hugged his dog tighter. In ancient Greece, life was harder than now. There wasn't enough food. There was war a lot. There were lots of diseases, and they didn't have good medicine, so doctors couldn't fix things. A lot of people were in pain and hungry all the time, and afraid of getting conquered or enslaved, and everyone had to see lots of friends die. If you weren't hungry or thirsty and weren't sick and no one was hurting you, and you weren't sad from having a friend die, that was very rare and good. So they thought of that as pleasure, a state with no pain. Can you see how that would make sense in their world? Bridger half buried his face in the blue fur, sad at the thought of lives so hard. I guess. Yeah. That's sad to think, though. Man: yes, it is. But if death also meant that all that stopped, no hunger, pain, or sadness, then, by the negative definition, death was also pleasure. Child: then why didn't they all just kill themselves? Man: some people did back then. But the Epicureans say that you should still try to be happy as much as you can in life, in simple ways that are hard to destroy, like conversation or thinking about philosophy. You can do that even if you're sick or alone or lose your home in war. The boy's jaw set, his serious face adorable in its effort to imitate his battle-wearied guardians. The major and the soldiers in Mycroft told me what war is like. They say it's the second worst thing in the world. Man: that's an interesting definition. What do they say is the worst thing? Child: not having anything worth fighting for in the first place. The sensei looked again to the frowning major and his men, thinking ahead perhaps to their future sessions, as Bridger gave him this first sample of a veteran's mind. Man: that's a very powerful thought. Child: yeah. But we don't have to have war anymore. Life is good. Good enough to be worth fighting for, but we don't have to fight. No more countries, no more armies, no more war. Carlyle nodded. I bet your little soldiers still have a pretty tough life, being tiny and not being able to go out into the world and meet people, and remembering the war and friends that died in it. I bet Poynter had some bad things about their life, as well as good things. Child: I guess so. Man: so before you do anything, you could think about whether those bad things might be enough to make it better not to bring Poynter back. Hints of pain made Bridger's voice grow weak. I don't know. Carlyle took a deep breath. Bridger, are you sad now? Child: yes. Priest: why are you sad? Because Poynter's dead. He buried his face fully in Boo's fur. The dog no longer big enough to shield the growing boy completely as it had the toddler. It made everybody sad. Me and Thisbe and the Major. Everybody's sad when their friends are dead. Even Mycroft. To my astonishment, Carlyle's eyes, too, grew wet with mourning for this plastic soldier he had never met. Or perhaps the tears were grander, for the countless lost souls of the past whom time had taken from us. Something shifted in his posture, marking some new phase of dialogue, now that he had pushed the child this far. Priest. What does being sad feel like? Child. It hurts. Carlyle leaned close. Bridger. Pointer loved you, didn't they? The boy wiped his nose on his sleeve. Yes? Priest. Pointer was a soldier, too. They loved the other soldiers, and worked hard for you and them, did hard things, risked their life. Pointer was willing to endure all kinds of pain to help you and the other soldiers, right? The Major smiled a self-satisfied smile here, as if he smelled meat in the argument at last and saw its end. Child. Yes? Priest. Did Pointer sometimes give up doing something nice and fun, like resting, to do something hard and not so fun for you? Child. Yeah, lots of times. Like being on watch when it was really cold. Priest. So Pointer would choose to give up pleasure and face pain for you? Child. Yeah. Priest. Then, even if death is better than being alive, do you think Pointer would be willing to be alive again to help you and the other soldiers? Child. Yes, the child answered. Yes, Pointer would want to be here to help us. Even if death is nice, they'd still want to be here to help us. So then it can be okay to bring Pointer back, even if death isn't bad. Bridger smiled at last, and I felt the warmth of the conclusion spread through myself as well. I am no censor. In Carlyle's place, I would have just said that death is bad and that of course he should bring Pointer back. But that would have brought a world of pain upon the child. Do you still not see it, reader? The moral consequences 10 steps further along, which Carlyle foresees as clearly as signposts on a road? If Bridger had brought Pointer back on the theory that it's always better to be alive than dead, then what about the other plastic corpses lost somewhere in the trench dust? He should bring them back. What about Emma Plutz, Leslie's parents, the recently deceased sensei Carlyle replaced? What about the stranger who died yesterday in a hospital on the far side of the world? Or every stranger, every death, back to the dawn of time. Soon the nightmare guilt that sometimes kept me up at night would kindle in the boy, and make him feel that every single soul that ever died was on his conscience for not resurrecting them. But this way, deciding based on what the soldier personally would want, Bridger could bring Pointer back and still reserve the possibility of death being okay, and not take up the burden, yet, of saving all of us. At this point, I sent my silent signal to Thisbe and the Major that I thought this sensei could be trusted. But what if there's a god? Only a child could ask so bluntly, reader. I will spare you the next part. You may assume that Carlyle stayed with Bridger in the garden for another hour, leading him through the hypotheticals of Nirvana, Gehenna, Guinea, Mictlan, hell, of nothingness, of reincarnation, of souls returning, souls merging, souls evaporating, no souls at all, presenting many options and leaving many open doors. Their conclusions were neither solely Bridger's nor solely Carlyle's, but discoveries made striding hand in hand through theology's well-trodden ground. When I returned that evening to find Poynter alive and well among his comrades, with no memory of his dead hours but a sleep-like sense of warmth and darkness, I thanked Carlyle in my heart for Bridger's smiles.